I would say we are back, not at the first inning, because I think that, you know, obviously the equities are up considerably from the very bottom. I would say we're probably in closer to the second or the third inning. And I don't think we're going to see this shift until the West can expand enrichment capacity. And that's going to take many years and billions of dollars of capital. So this could very well be a really, really strong run for like a 3 to 5 year period.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with uranium energy sector analyst Justin Huhn. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Justin, where he explains the likely massive global increase ahead in demand for nuclear energy, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Justin also explains where he sees the greatest opportunities ahead for investors in the uranium sector, so be sure to stick around for that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Justin Huhn. All right, well, let's get to the key reason. You know, we've been talking here now for over an hour. Thanks for giving me so much of your time.
My pleasure, yeah.
And now we're getting to the real meat of, okay, so why are we doing this on a show that's about, you know, investing? You wrote recently, highly called out on your website, the following quote: the uranium sector, in my opinion, offers the most asymmetric risk reward profile I've seen in my entire career. I believe that we are on the cusp of an enormous move in the sector. All right. So you've told us why the technology makes so much sense here. Why are you so, what are the specific reasons that you are bullish for, you know, the sector as an investment class to do so well going forward?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of what we've talked about already has to do with, you know, kind of part of the bullish thesis, which is it's a growth sector. There's a lot of fantastic energy and enthusiasm around nuclear right now. And like I said, unfortunately, it's really been highlighted with, you know, the global energy crisis that we're seeing. But it being embraced as a green energy, I think, has a lot of potential for further growth going forward into the next couple of decades. So, A, it's a growth sector. Why am I so bullish right now? Okay, so starting a number of years ago, there was already a pretty glaring deficit with supply. So you had the commodity trading at $18 a pound at the bottom. That was well below the cost of production, which at the time was probably the average cost of production was probably in the 40s, maybe into the low 50s, if you looked at dollars per pound. And it was trading for $18 a pound. And the reason for that was that there was drastic oversupply in the previous decade. So after Fukushima, Fukushima obviously was not great for sentiment, right? So you had the markets react to that accident. But the real nail in the coffin from Fukushima had to do with Japan being almost 15% of global demand for uranium because they had 54 reactors. They shut all of them off after Fukushima, even though all of those reactors perfectly survived an absolutely enormous earthquake. And huge, that earthquake was over 9 on the Richter scale. That is unbelievably huge. All of the reactors survived that earthquake. Obviously, Fukushima did not survive the tsunami that followed the earthquake because the backup generators got flooded. Okay, 54 reactors in Japan got shut off overnight. Germany shut down more than half their fleet in a couple of years following Fukushima. They continued that phase out. So between Germany and Japan, we're talking 15%+ of global demand went off in a couple of years. While production continued, these mines are very, very difficult and complex to bring online and very capital intensive. And so they continue to produce even into reduced demand. So we had hundreds of millions of pounds of excess of production in the previous decade. That took a long time to work through. Finally, 2018, the commodity bottomed right around the time when Cameco decided to put McArthur River, the world's largest uranium mine, in care and maintenance. So a number of mines had come offline in previous years, smaller mines. Cameco did that. Just like, hey, we're going to take one for the team. We're going to spend $10 million a month to keep this thing in care and maintenance because we need this commodity to come back to prices that can justify us being in business. And so that happened. the supply and demand disjunct was obvious starting around that time. Okay, so you had, let's say, 175 million pounds of annual demand of uranium, uranium equivalent in global reactors. This year, we're going to produce about 135 million pounds of uranium globally. Last year, it was about the same, actually a little bit less because we had some shutdowns due to COVID in 2020 that affected 2021 production. And basically, since McArthur River was shut off, we had a significant supply deficit relative to demand. And that has gone a long way to work through a lot of that oversupply, which brings us to the present day, where we have a spot market, which is basically the settlement of a sale of uranium of less than 12 months. A spot market, which is very thin, a very small amount of purchasing is having drastic effects on the price of the spot price of uranium. Last year, Sprott entered the space and they started the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. They took over the Uranium Participation Corporation, which was a physical trust, a physical fund that started in 2005, I believe. They accumulated 18 million pounds over 16 years. Sprott took over UPC. They implemented an at-the-market financing vehicle, an ATM, $3.5 billion now. They've raised almost $2 billion, I think $1.8 billion in 12 months, and they've purchased almost 40 million pounds of uranium in 12 months. They purchased, and most of that was last year, they purchased about 16 million pounds this year so far. So they've cleared out the spot market. And yes, there's always a little bit of production that's being sold into the spot market, you know, 2-3 million pounds a month, let's say. But it's very thin. And they have this ATM vehicle, whenever they're trading at a premium to NAV, they can issue shares in the market and use that money to buy uranium. So it's an investment vehicle that investors are now aware that their dollars going into this vehicle can actually lead to uranium purchases, which moves the price of uranium and moves the equity space, which generally move along with the commodity itself. The big change that has happened this year to that setup, and I hope that I made that clear enough in a very short period of time, it's really complex, but basically we're producing far fewer pounds of uranium than we're consuming on a global basis annually. That's really the gist of the thesis. Bring us to 2022.
Right, and I'm sorry, and that's for just existing demand, correct?
That's existing demand. Yep. Yeah, not future demand. And that's, you know, 175 million pounds ish a year. You know, that really depends on the tails assay of enrichment, which is kind of complicated, but it's an important point that I'll have to make when talking about Russia in just a second. But that doesn't include secondary demand from financial players. So we're talking, you know, 40 million pounds of secondary demand in the last 12 months. So if you add that to that 170, 170 million pounds of primary demand from actual electricity production, we're north of 200 million pounds a year, with 135 million produced this year, expected to be produced anyways. Okay, so bring us to the present year. Okay, Russia invading Ukraine, effectively what has happened, although there are no official sanctions at this point, Russia has not cut off its shipments of enriched uranium. The West has not necessarily cut off its purchasing or let's say accepting of deliveries from previous contracts of Russian uranium. But what we're seeing is what we're calling self-sanctioning. The utilities in the West, to my knowledge, and according to all of the contacts that I have in the sector, have not signed any new contracts with Russia since this war has broken out. A lot of the utilities in the West and the EU and the US continue to receive deliveries of Russian uranium, but there's a big question of how long that is going to go on. We're already talking about news last week that the DOE is seeking $1.5 billion in funding the Department of Energy in the United States to support a low-enriched uranium and HALEU, high-assay low-enriched uranium production line in the United States. Now, there is some enrichment in the United States. I think it's 4.9 million SWU at Urenco in SWU is separate of work unit. It's basically the cost of enrichment in New Mexico in the United States, but that's about 20% of the West's enrichment capacity. So it's not a whole lot. The US knows we've got a problem here. We've been highly dependent on Russian uranium for a very long time and we need to fix it now. And it took this crisis to create that problem or to highlight the problem. So to put this into perspective, Russia is a major producer of enrichment, 40% of global enrichment. They're about 30% of global conversion. The West is the bulk of uranium demand in nuclear energy production, about 70%. Now, when I say the West, I'm talking about the OECD countries. The East we'll consider, let's say, the BRICS nations, right? So the bulk of nuclear energy production is in the West. That's about 70%. And we only have about 40% of enrichment capacity in the West. So that presents interesting problem. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time to expand enrichment capacity. Enrichment is, besides fabrication of fuel, enrichment is the last stage in the fuel cycle and arguably the most important because of our reliance on Russian enrichment. So basically what's happening right now is Western enrichers are having to do something called overfeed the centrifuges. And I'll try to be quick with this, and I'll try to put it in layman's terms as much as possible. But it's really important to understand this, because this is why I'm so bullish in the short to the midterm. That's on top of the basic supply and demand fundamentals in a growth sector and nuclear is being embraced as a green technology, et cetera, right? You have this basic thesis, and then you have this gasoline on the fire, which is this situation with Russian supply and the Western demand. Okay, so Western enrichers are having to overfeed their centrifuges, which means they operate these centrifuges at a specific tails assay. And what that is the amount of the fissile U-235 that's left over in the waste material, in the tails. It's not really waste because they can re-enrich it. This excess U-235 in the tails is known as the tails assay. They've been operating, relatively speaking, in the West for the past number of years at around 0.17 to 0.2 tails assay. So what they're doing now is they're having to produce more enriched uranium faster because the demand just kicked up major notch due to the West. The West is now seeking Western enrichment at a much higher level than they were 6 months ago. So for Urenco, let's say, which is a Western enricher, they have a facility in America and in the UK. Their tails assays have already risen from, let's say, 0.18 to 0.24, 0.25. They're having to do this to produce enrichment faster and to produce more enriched uranium faster. So what that means is they're signing long-term contracts at an even higher tails assay, you know, probably pushing 0.28, 0.29, 0.3, which requires a lot more feed. Okay, so if you imagine the centrifuge process as basically like an apple press, and let's just assume that every apple has the same amount of juice in it, right? So at 0.18 tails assay, you're talking about a certain amount of apples, and it's a certain amount of energy goes in to squeeze those apples to produce the needed enrichment, enriched uranium out the far end of that process. By bumping up the tails assay, what they're doing is they're using more apples and they're using less energy to press those apples to produce more. So you need way more feed coming in the front end to produce the same amount, let alone more enriched uranium out the far end of that process. So what that means is not only is the demand jumping up considerably right now for Western enrichers because of this overfeeding process, the underfeeding that has been happening in the previous decade is gone. So to the same extent that these centrifuges are needing to be overfed with more UF6 on the front end of the process, in the past, when the enrichers had excess capacity due to lower demand, what they could do is they could take that excess of capacity, and let's say an enricher signed a contract with a nuclear utility for 0.2 tails, right? And that dictates the amount of feedstock the utility has to provide to the enricher, the tails and the SWU. So basically, if they signed a contract at 0.2 and they had all this excess capacity, they would actually spin it down to 0.18 or 0.17 and use less of the uranium that was given to them by the nuclear utility. They would underfeed the centrifuge because they had excess capacity. That means they had extra UF6 they could sell into the spot market. Okay, so global underfeeding for the past decade has been about 20 to 25 million pounds a year. It's basically the biggest mine in the world. And that essentially is being cut off. Why? The West is not underfeeding any longer because of this big jump in demand. And the underfeeding that's coming from Russia is staying in Russia. The West is not buying that material any longer or contracting for it in the future. So what we're seeing, based on underfeeding essentially being cut off to the West and this increased demand due to this overfeeding situation, we're seeing a huge, huge swing. I mean, we're talking about a 30 to 40, potentially more million pounds a year swing on top of the deficit that's already sitting at 30 to 40 million pounds a year, not to even get into secondary demand from financial players. So essentially, to wrap this all up, this bifurcated market, Russia, non-Russia, and plenty of countries are still going to buy from Russia, right? The Mexicans, the Brazilians, the Indians are probably all going to still buy from Russia. So we're really talking about the West. It's a huge, huge change in the nuclear fuel cycle. It's a huge change to how Western nuclear utilities, which is the bulk, which is almost three quarters of the global uranium demand, is a huge change to how they're having to operate, how they're having to buy uranium going forward. And I mean, I can keep diving into it, but I just want, you have any questions around any of that? I think it's a really important point to make, because this already rosy situation from an investment perspective of this growth sector, et cetera, now we actually have a bifurcated market that is likely to remain going forward, at least for the mid, short to midterm. I think even if the war ends miraculously tomorrow, I really don't see the EU and the US saying, okay, all is forgiven, let's go back to business as usual. I don't think that's going to happen. So this situation has basically poured gasoline on the fire, and the fire was this supply deficit going out into the future. And it's a wild setup. It really is. And I think that the demand is going to hit the U308 market because of this overfeeding from bifurcation situation. It's going to hit it very, very soon. I mean, we're talking weeks, potentially, you know, maybe a few months.
Okay. So we've got this perfect storm, we'll say, looking with the investor's eyes, of opportunity. So what do you see as the best ways to consider playing this? One, I presume, could play just the spot price of uranium. And if so, let us know what ways somebody could do that. Is it the miners themselves that present a great opportunity here? Is it kind of the picks and shovels equivalent, like the people that are supplying these companies? I mean, I think this is sort of what you do on a day-to-day basis for your subscribers there at Uranium Insider. So where do you see the big opportunity here for investors?
Sure. Well, to answer the first part of your question, yes, you can invest essentially in the commodity itself. I mean, you can actually buy uranium. That is possible, physical uranium, and have it stored at a conversion facility. Now, you have to pay, you know, 7% a year or something like that, storage fee for that uranium. So it's not exactly the best way, but there are family funds, there are hedge funds that do buy physical uranium as a bet on this expected continuation of a bull market. Easiest way for investors to expose themselves to the commodity itself is to buy one of the physical funds. And that would be either Yellow Cake, that's listed on the London Exchange, or the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, that's listed in Canada. They have an OTC listing in the States as well, but and you can buy that in Canadian dollars or US dollars on the TSX. The Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, you know, affectionately known as SPUT, is very highly liquid. It's probably the least risky play if you believe in the thesis and want to be long the commodity. Has a lot of liquidity, so there's no real issues on that front. And it's about 80% owned by institutions. So it's kind of an institutional darling in terms of exposure to the sector. The real leverage comes from the miners, and that's really the bulk of the rest of the ways that you can play it. Obviously, there are some ETFs. There's a very small ETF in Canada called the Horizons ETF. There's URA, which is the most liquid, that is actually only about 70%, I believe, exposed to actual uranium mining stocks. There's a number of other mining stocks held by the company. This had to do with the fund not wanting to own too high of a percentage of each individual companies and wanting more liquidity in the fund. It's possible they increase that percentage of ownership as the sector grows. The whole sector is still right around $40 billion market capitalization for the entire publicly traded uranium sector. It's very, very small. And then you have the URNM, which is the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF. So I would say the safest and most liquid is the SPUT vehicle. If you want just, you know, kind of the shotgun approach, you'd buy the ETF. But for us, you know, having a uranium focused newsletter, we really have our own process that we use to find what we feel are the best risk reward investments in the space. And that has to do with a number of varying factors that we look at for every company in the space. That has to do, obviously, with management. We look for managers that have operated in a responsible manner, let's say during the bear market, which is not an easy thing to do. We look for management that has had previous successes. We obviously look at jurisdiction. We don't like to make risky jurisdiction bets. There's a couple of companies that, there's a company that has Berkeley Energy has a project in Spain that is unlikely to ever get off the ground. It's a great deposit, actually, but very risky from a jurisdictional standpoint. Our favorite positions are those in companies that have individual company catalysts for the expected bull market. So that the company is not just sitting on pounds in the ground waiting for the commodity to rise and the rising tide to raise all ships. And the rising tide has raised all ships over the past 3 or 4 years since we've been in a general uptrend for the sector. But drastic differences in returns for some of these stocks. There are some stocks that are up, maybe 50 to 100% over the past 4 or 5 years, which sounds great, and it is. There are stocks that are up more than 10x over the same time period. And so stock picking is difficult, and it's something that we've done very well so far. We outperformed the URNM ETF last year. I think we did 128% last year. URNM did in the 70th percentile. Part of that is we also recommend some very intelligently structured options trades to give a little bit of lower risk torque. But we like companies that have individual company catalysts. So whether that's a developer becoming a producer, whether that's a roll-up strategy, there's a number of different ways that companies can have expected or unexpected, and the unexpected are the best. So if you can actually see the future for a company, that really can bring incredible returns. If the management tells you their plans and the market does not understand or price it in, that has been, and we expect to be, big winners going forward.
Okay. And, I'm resisting asking you for any particular company names, assuming that that's the bread and butter of your service. There is actually revealing which companies that you think are the best. So I'll give folks a chance in just a minute, Justin, to tell folks where they can go learn more about your newsletter. couple questions. One, so you mentioned that the mining sector has already kind of started to take off. Right, you've had some companies up 50 to 100%, like you said, but you've had some companies up 1,000%, the 10Xers you talked about. What inning are we in here, in your estimation? I guess my question is, has the bulk of the upside already been captured by those moves, or are we just still in the early days here, in your opinion?
I think if we had had this interview a number of months ago, I would have said that we were probably in the third or fourth inning. I think that we got a big reset this year, thanks to markets being generally risk off. The stocks are basically flat for the year for the most part, which actually has outperformed a lot, all things right. considered, right? Right? There's been flat massive wealth destruction this year. I honestly think, and I don't know can I share my screen really quick?
Sure.
I want to show a really interesting chart. Can you see this okay?
Yep.
All right. So this chart is showing URNM relative to the spot futures price. So basically what this is the miners relative to the metal. All, just kind of very, very broad view of how are the miners performing against the actual commodity itself. So this is back in December of 2020, in my opinion, was the start of the bull market for the equities. Now, the commodity bottomed a couple of years before that, right? Or multiple years before that in 2016. But the actual sector really took off. And you can say, oh yeah, the bull market started in March of 2020. Now everything crashed then. I don't really consider the bull market starting as a recovery to a crash. This is really when the sector took off and started to outperform everything. Was December 2020. Okay. So this is URNM, or a basket of miners, compared to the commodity. We obviously went on a big run that pulled back into last summer. We went on another good run when the SPUT ATM went live in August of last year, and they started scooping up pounds like crazy. The commodity took off, the equities took off, and most of the stocks in this space peaked out last autumn. Now, some are closer near all-time highs right now, multi-year highs. But most of the equities peaked, and then we obviously, relative to the commodity itself, slid all the way down. This bottomed again. Look at this, July. This is last month, or about 6 weeks ago. Back at the same levels before the bull market even started.
Yeah, you're right.
Relative to the metal. So yes, the metal is up. When the bull market started, the metal was $32 a pound. Now we're sitting at about $50 a pound. But in my opinion, the setup here is totally different and exponentially better than it was at the beginning of the bull market. At the beginning of the bull market, we were still relying on a you know 25, 30 million supply deficit annually, and that going into soaking up above ground mobile inventory. Now, not only have we had let's see, almost 40 million pounds of above ground mobile inventory cleared out by the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in the past 12 months, but now we have a bifurcated market with a 30, 40 plus million pound swing from supply to demand. It's the setup is entirely different here. So long answer short, I would say we are back, not at the first inning, because I think that, you know, obviously the equities are up considerably from the very bottom. I would say we're probably in closer to the second or the third inning. And I don't think we're going to see this shift until the West can expand enrichment capacity. And that's going to take many years and billions of dollars of capital. So this could very well be a really, really strong run for like a 3 to 5 year period. And this continues to be a moving target, but the market moves. I mean, if you would have asked me 2 years ago, I would have said, let's look at a 3 to 5 year bull market for uranium, right? So 2 years have passed, but so much has changed. And I think that the run could be very strong. If we see demand, so to kind of circle back just for a minute, I won't be long with this, to kind of just circle back. So what we've seen is huge moves in enrichment conversion this year. So enrichment and conversion are both up over 100% this year. And that's kind of the back end of the fuel cycle. But what happens is utilities, especially in the West, are trying to secure that enrichment conversion because Russia is and was such a big player in those two elements of the fuel cycle, that you do that first. You sign those enrichment contracts, and that dictates how much uranium you have to buy in the front end to move through the fuel cycle, right? That enrichment contract tells you have to provide us with this many kgU of UF6. Then they have to buy the uranium. And prior, when there was excess enrichment capacity, utilities could buy enrichment. They could just literally go to the enricher, buy UF6, and have it enriched. They didn't even need to engage with the miners to a certain extent. Now they have to buy the uranium. And that's the demand that's coming from this shift from underfeeding to overfeeding in this bifurcated market. And I think it's coming really, really soon. And we're actually, this is good timing for this interview. You know, the WNA conference is literally happening right now in London. I was unfortunately not able to attend, but we have somebody there. Going forward, this is a seasonally strong period for uranium typically. And I think this year didn't really happen last year. It happened early. It happened, you know, August to November. Typically, it's October through February that's the seasonally strongest period for uranium. That has to do with, you know, on the heels of kind of the slow period in the summer, fuel buyers come back to their desks. They get new budgets in October in the US. You have the WNA conference, you have nuclear fuel conferences in October. And so seasonally, this is a strong period for uranium, but I think this year it's going to potentially get wild. And if all of that I just mentioned there, having to do with demand coming to uranium from the existing demand that's currently hidden in the conversion, the enrichment markets due to this bifurcation. If that happens simultaneously with risk coming back on into markets, specifically into the spot vehicle, it really could be an exponential move. I mean, and I'm not saying that is going to happen. I mean, we still definitely could see some risk off across markets going forward here, considering everything else in the broader macro sense with you know, a rate hike environment and recessionary markers being relatively strong. But if risk comes back on in a rising price environment for the commodities itself, then we could see some explosive moves.
All right. Well, look, super fascinating. We're now getting near an hour 40 minutes here, so I hate to have to bring this to a close, Justin, but it's been a wonderful conversation, and I want to invite you to come back on again in the future here, especially if we start seeing the activity that you just mentioned could be happening this year. So we'll get multiple bites at this apple going forward. One last question before we wrap things up. You mentioned that the market cap for the miners was something like 40 billion in total, right? Which is not that much
Right.
in the big picture. And for something that might have so much strategic value for the world's energy future, I'm just curious. My brain thinks about this in other similar markets as well that are strategic but small. I mean, a couple billionaires could just lock this whole thing up, right? or a couple big players, a couple big companies, you know, energy companies and other sectors could just say, you know what, it's kind of a play on the future. Let's just buy, you know, half of these companies. You're sort of nodding and smirking as I'm saying this. I mean, is that a crazy thought to have?
It's not. I mean, I wouldn't say it's part of the core thesis, but you know, this market is so small, it's ripe to be cornered. And there's so few companies. There's only 70 companies in the entire publicly traded space that are uranium miners or even anything. You know, NuScale is an actual SMR developer, and you have the ETFs and you have a couple of physical funds, but the bulk of them are miners. And so it's such a small market that when real money comes into it, the moves are very, very violent. It's a very volatile sector to the upside and to the downside. So it takes kind of, you have to have a strong stomach for this sector. And we always recommend to make a rational allocation, you know, in every monthly newsletter that we put out in bold letters is make a rational allocation to the sector because the punch is above its weight. You don't need to put your entire net's worth into uranium stock. It's probably not a smart thing to do, but, you're absolutely right. And I honestly think the awareness of the market is growing. I mean, it's been mentioned on Fast Money a couple of times in the past couple of months. You know, Bloomberg is writing about it all the time now. It's articles about the growth of nuclear in the Wall Street Journal. The word is kind of starting to get out. And in my opinion, the fact that Sprott is managing this physical trust that has bought 40 million pounds in the past 12 months, I think it's honestly a matter of risk coming back onto the financial markets and the guys at Sprott just picking up the phone. I mean, it really is not going to take much. I mean, we've had John Cimpaglia has been a guest on our monthly webinars twice now. We do a monthly webinar for our members every month. And he's told us over a couple of occasions that, you know, he's having conversations with fund managers that are managing north of hundreds of billions in AUM. And he's even spoken to north of a trillion. And obviously this sector is so small, they can't even touch it. And there's plenty of fund managers that literally have this in their radar, and they think totally differently than retail. So retail is like, well, why aren't they just coming in now? It's like, you don't get it. Liquidity is primary. If you're managing $100 billion, liquidity is paramount. And if the liquidity is not there, you can't touch it despite the opportunity, despite how good it looks as a setup. So he said that these guys are literally just waiting for there to be sufficient volume on a daily basis being traded in that vehicle, and then they're in. And I tend to believe him. I think that this thing is his baby. He was working on it for over 3 years before he actually was able to take over UPC. So I take a lot of faith in the fact that Sprott is managing this vehicle. And when you add that to like just everything else, I mean, I hate to just be so overtly bullish and sounding like I'm talking my book, but I'd love to have holes poked in this thesis because I just, you know, there's always a risk of a nuclear accident like we talked about. Unless there's a big shift in demand, like after Fukushima with all the reactors coming offline, that caused the bear market. I don't know what pokes a hole in this, especially in the short to midterm. It's really an exciting place to be.
All right. Two quick things. One, I interviewed John Cimpaglia from Sprott not very long after that Sprott launched the Physical Uranium Trust. Folks, if you are really spun up on this subject now and would like to hear more about that interview with John, I'll link to it right here. Be a good one to watch after this one. You know, talking about sort of the opportunity here, you know, we've had literally kind of, you and I are about the same age, our whole lives, the media has taken, I think, sounded a cautionary tone on nuclear energy. And if now governments are going to re-embrace it and need to bring the public along, you know, there could be a massive sort of media campaign coming ahead with the rebranding. Hey, it's actually now a green source of energy. You know, it's actually our concerns are getting addressed. Maybe we didn't fully understand the situation. Now with the future we need, it's this essential bridge to the future. So, you know, if that starts happening as well, that's going to bring a lot more attention, focus, and probably capital to the space as well. And obviously that hasn't really even started yet.
Absolutely. Yeah. The narrative shift is something that was never even really part of the original thesis to be long this commodity. You go back 3 or 4 years, we never ever would have expected Diablo Canyon to be saved, expected it to be included in the green taxonomy in the EU, expected a Democrat majority and bipartisan bill, including funding to keep reactors online in the United States. So all of these things were never part of that thesis. And to your point, I think one of the most profound things, and this is one of the reasons why the sector kind of took off again a couple of weeks back, is Japan, the new prime minister in Japan is talking about accelerating the restarts in Japan. So this is the country that actually has experienced the nuclear accident that's most fresh in everybody's minds, and the only country that's ever experienced, unfortunately, the non-peaceful use of nuclear back in World War II, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that country that has experienced both of those things is saying, oh yeah, we need this. And they're trying to get their restarts. There's 33 operable reactors there now. So about 20 have been decommissioned permanently. 9 or 10 have been restarted, and they're shooting for 20 to 22% of their grid by 2030, which would be another 20 restarts in the next 7 years. So that's pretty aggressive for that country that has experienced the most negative thing in everybody's minds of recent memory for nuclear, is saying, yeah, we're going back into nuclear. Very, very exciting. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, look, Justin, for the folks that have really enjoyed getting to know you through this interview, would like to follow you and your work, presumably maybe consider subscribing to your newsletter to find out the specific companies that you're most interested in. Where should they go?
Uraniuminsider.com is where they can find information about us and about our newsletter. And I'm pretty prevalent on Twitter as well, at Uranium Insider. And yes, definitely the company, the positioning recommendations, I think, is a big part of what we offer. But even a bigger part is really breaking down the fundamentals. So we go deep into the macro, and this sector is so volatile. I think that one of the best services that we've offered is really an explanation of the fundamental setup and helping people to kind of stomach the volatility and hang in there, let's say, because it does shake a lot of people out.
All right. Well, look, when we edit this, we'll put up the links to your website there and your Twitter account. It has been just an absolutely fascinating and very educational discussion here, Justin. I think you've opened a lot of eyes here, a lot of minds. And like I said, I'd love to have you back on the program, particularly maybe even in the fall here, if we start seeing this seasonal shift that you're looking for here, as well as anything else that might be happening in the story. Given all the different factors in play here, this is a very multifactorial environment out there. There are things that could happen to either accelerate this or depress it, very quickly in either direction. So it'd be great to have you on here, kind of calling audibles for us as this goes along.
It'd be my pleasure.
All right. Well, look, thanks so much, Justin. It's been a real pleasure. Look forward to having you back on soon.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me on.
We hope you enjoyed this interview with Justin Huhn. If you did, please support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below if you haven't already, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Justin for free, just go to wealtheon.com/adamsnotes. Also, I just want to provide a quick reminder that Wealtheon's upcoming fall conference is now less than 3 weeks away. If you missed out on our early bird price discount, which just expired this past weekend, you can still take advantage of our last chance to save 15% discount before tickets rise to full price soon. To lock that in, go to wealtheon.com/conference right now. And finally, if you're interested in investing in this space, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help develop a plan for you around the trends and opportunities that Justin has mentioned here. Just go to wealtheon.com, fill out the short form there, and we'll help get one set up for you. Okay, I'll see you in our next video. Thanks for watching, everyone.
Thank you.